You found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. We're live. It's Tuesday, May 7th. Thank you for tuning us in. If you're listening live, we appreciate that. If you're listening because you've downloaded the podcast later, we appreciate that as well. And if you'd like to do that, you are just there's free apps that you can do so that you can load it, download it to your iPhone or your Android, and they're easy, and then you are portable. You can take us wherever you are, because we want to become an integral part of your day. We start out with the top five news stories that you should be paying attention to or know about so that you've got water cooler talk, or that people understand that you know what's going on in the news. And then we have various guests on depending on what's in the news or what their field of expertise is. This morning we have one of the nation's bird experts slash mallard experts slash ducks in our colloquial terms. He's going to be visiting with us because it's spring, as you may have noticed, and there's lots of rites of passage, including mating, and I have a personal story about ducks and the community that I live in, so he's going to give us some insight about that. And then we also have a woman on the program. She's in the UK. She has a forgiveness group, and there are a couple stories in the news that forgiveness has come up. Mark Sanford running for Congress in South Carolina, it was one of them that he spoke this morning. They're having their elections today, and he talked about forgiveness and how he thinks the people have forgiven him, and that's why he's neck and neck with his competition, Steve Colbert's sister. And then there's another story in the news that's dealing with forgiveness, and that's about the mother who abandoned her family 11 years ago, and she's back in the scene, and her 19-year-old daughter is very angry with her and mentions that she might not be able to forgive her mother just yet. And so that's why we're taking a story and then giving you the angle on what forgiveness is. But before we get to our duck conversation, the stories that you should know about are the three Ohio women who were recovered last night just south of downtown Cleveland after 10 years in captivity. They were released this morning from the Metro Health Emergency Department in fairly good condition. Amanda Berry was last seen finishing her shift at Burger King in Cleveland in 2003. She was 16. The next day she was to be 17. Gina De Jesus disappeared nearly a year later in April 2004. She was 14. Michelle Knight vanished in 2002 at the age of 19, and they were all found alive last night thanks to a neighbor's intervention. Three men have been arrested. Ariel Castro, 52 years old, he is a former school bus driver. He is the resident of the home, and they say his two brothers were also arrested based on the testimony from the women last night, and they're in jail awaiting charges. So, of course, you may recall the J.C. Dugard story, which she was freed in 2002 after 18 years of captivity behind the home of the California couple that abducted them, and she had two daughters due to the chronic raping of the man that held her captive. So these three gals are going to have quite the story, but the one thing that is going through this is that some of the family members said that they never gave up hope. They said there was a link. They didn't feel that their spirits were gone. And it's apparently becoming more common that people who have been captured are being found. So I love the story. I mean, obviously 10 years of captivity is horrific. It's more than half their lives. And the suffering that they have to go through and their recovery is going to be very difficult, I'm sure. But congratulations on that story. I like good news stories as much as possible. On a somber note, the limo fire that was in Northern California over the weekend. Yesterday, the reports were that it was a bachelorette party. And indeed, apparently it was. But the woman that was one of the ones that was perished in the fire, who was The Bachelorette. Turns out she actually had been married, and she was going to get remarried in her native country, which is the Philippines. So she was going to hold another wedding ceremony with her relatives. So there is stories coming out today about who did what and how. And one of the survivors said that she made her way up to the front of the limo, and there's that partition that can go up or down, and she knocked on it, and she said something about smoke, and the driver turns around, he says, no smoking is allowed. So she knocks again, and he lowers the window, and she ended up crawling through it and landed in the front seat, and she says, you've got to pull over, there's a fire. So he says that he pulled over as soon as he could. He was on the San Mateo Hayward Bridge, which is, they were going to a hotel in Foster City, so that's south of San Francisco. And so some escaped, and then when they got out of the limo, they opened the back door to let the other ones out, and apparently that provided the oxygen that just the fire then engulfed the car. So the ones that perished, they said that their bodies were next to the partition, so they had been getting away from the fire. The fire apparently started somewhere in the trunk. They think it's electrical. All of that stuff is to be reviewed. But the Public Utilities Commission weighed in because the vehicle was supposed to carry 8 or fewer passengers. It had 9. Limostop is the name of the company. They are licensed, and they've shown evidence of liability insurance, although reports earlier this morning disproved that, but this is as of we speak this now. They haven't been the target of any previous enforcement actions. Limousines are not required to have fire extinguishers in them. The U.S. Department of Transportation has weighed in. They say 5 people died in 3 separate stretch limo accidents in 2010. 21 people died in another 3 stretch limo accidents in 2011. Now, I didn't know this, but stretch limos are built in 2 ways. One, the first process is a car maker builds the limousine body, then another company customizes it or stretches the vehicle. This second company that does that has to issue a certificate that the car meets the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration safety standards for new vehicles, and that all the safety equipment is working as required before it can be sold to the public. In the second process, a customer buys the limousine directly from the car maker, then takes it to be customized. But modifying the car after it has been sold is considered a retrofit, so it's not something that the National Highway Traffic Safety Association would regulate. So this is a 1999 Lincoln Town Car that caught fire. And again, all this investigation is going to be going on because there were 5 deaths, and it's such a tragic case. The officer in charge of a program to curb sexual assault in the Air Force was arrested over the weekend for allegedly grabbing a woman by the breasts and buttocks in a parking lot not far from the Pentagon. Yep. Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Krasinski, 41, was arrested on Sunday and charged with sexual battery. The Air Force's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office that he headed, he's been removed from his job yesterday pending the investigation. An Arlington County police spokesman said he was under the influence of alcohol, grabbed the woman by the breasts and the butt in a parking lot. She fended him off. When he tried to grab her again, that's when she called the police, who arrived and detained him. So the Air Force has confirmed that he was a lieutenant colonel in charge of the office responsible for overseeing the service's sexual assault policy and developing prevention and response programs. What a sad story this is. News of the arrest comes as the Pentagon is preparing to release its annual report on the problem of sexual assault in the military. According to them, a total of 3,200 cases were reported in the fiscal year that ended September 30th, 2011. But Pentagon officials saying that that number is low. Though, including those that go unreported, they're guessing there may be as many as 19,000 cases of sexual assault in a year. So what do they call that? The fox watching the hen house. So over 120 burial offers have been presented to the Worcester Funeral Home director, Peter Stefan, to have the body buried here in the United States of Tamerlan Tsarnaev. And when he calls the officials in those cities and towns where the graves are located, everyone still says no. So Tsarnaev's mother has expressed interest in sending his body to Russia, And in order to do that, they have to file paperwork with the Russian embassy in the United States. In the meantime, the body must be rotting, right? It's been weeks now. So the funeral home director says it's not only Massachusetts that doesn't want him, nobody wants him. And all these people who have donated graves, I've made some calls and said to somebody in the cities and towns where the graves were, hey, would you like to bury the guy there that was part of the marathon bombing? And he says the response is the same. You're not going to do that here. And in that story, one of the three friends that was arrested was released yesterday on $100,000 bail. He's going to be monitored electronically. He's going back to live with his mother. And he has been charged with making false statements to the bombing investigators. He's a U.S. citizen and a Boston native. The other two are from Kazakhstan. And finally in the news today, New Jersey Governor George Christie's office admitted this morning that he underwent lap band surgery in February. Lap band, as you may know, is a procedure where a silicone tube is wrapped around the upper part of the stomach, making it smaller and limiting the amount of food the stomach can hold. We're going to go into a little bit more of that later in the program. But right now we're going to call our guest. His name is Dr. Kevin McGowan. He is a bachelor's in zoology from Ohio State University, a master's in zoology from Ohio State, and a PhD in biology. Dr. Kevin McGowan, good morning. You're live on the Maria Sanchez Show. Hello. Thank you for visiting with us.
Good morning.
I would like to share with you, before we get into what you have to say, the reason that I was compelled to contact you. And it's spring, and there's lots of mating going on. And obviously, birds fall into that category, just like other animals in Mother Nature's world. But
oh, yeah.
I live in a community that has a freshwater lake in it. So we've got lots of ducks, or mallards, I guess is the technical term for them.
Uh-huh. That would be the species, yeah.
And first of all, there seems to be nothing consensual about their mating rituals that I have seen, because I actually had lived on the water and saw like up to six ducks waiting to have their way with the female. And I've seen them break her neck, and I've seen them drown her in the act because they mount her from behind and they push her head under. I've also seen them in my pool, and there will be two near her and four waiting. And I'm curious, how is this possible? Why does that exist? How it seems to me is savage.
It does seem savage. And there are a couple of things I should say about some of this is that the birds you're looking at are mostly domestic heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been domesticated for a while. And that does strange things to animals. But let me say, first of all, mallards actually do have very complex courtship behaviors. Sex among ducks is usually consensual, and you can see the male and female display to each other. They bob their heads together, sort of in unison, or you know, trying to syncopate synchronize their rhythm a little bit. And then the female lays her head down on the water, and she just becomes a straight board, basically. Sometimes the males don't get it right away, and they keep bobbing their heads for a little bit. But then finally, he usually mounts her. They seem to both enjoy it. He jumps off and swims a circle around her with his head on the water, near the water, and she always, always, always sits up and flaps and starts washing. But what happens with these groups of ducks is that they don't, especially the domestics don't form as strong a pair bond as the wild birds do. Typically the wild mallards, the male and female hang out together. They're actually, mallards like sex. This is they do a lot of recreational sex. When they're trying to pick their mates, they do it early in the season. I mean, as you say, this is spring, but a lot of the ducks were actually trying to find a mate back in November. And you can see a lot of very consensual recreational duck sex then if you go look for it. But now it's serious, and the sex is all about making babies now. And so the males, see, one of the things why ducks do this is because they can. I don't know if you know this, but most birds don't have penises. They have no organ to pass the sperm into the body of the female. And so most bird sex is they have what we call a cloaca. That's everything dumps into one little opening, and they have to do what people call a cloacal kiss to transfer sperm. But ducks are different. They have penises. And so guys with penises can do things, and these guys do. So there's they end up chasing females. Often it's just, you know, one forced copulation, but it does happen. Now, once it gets into the point where you say where they start killing the females, that's not adaptive, and anything that's that rugged will be selected against. But the guys that are randy enough to chase her down and inseminate her, that they actually do impregnate her, and she comes off with little rapist little boys with rapist genes or whatever, and so it continues to exist.
So what is about the group mentality? You're saying that that's maladaptive?
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, it depends on, you know, who gets to mate, and a lot of these things do result in offspring. Not if they break her neck, of course, but most of the time they don't do that, and a lot of those copulations do, in fact, result in little chicks later on. So the broods from a female can have multiple males, it's just not that obvious why it should be going on, but it does work.
Because I've seen in the one incident where I saw them kill her, break her neck, they kept mounting the corpse then.
Yeah, you know, you get guys riled up. It doesn't all have to be exactly what, you look at, porn magazines and all kinds of stuff. You can get guys interested in things that aren't just right. You know? So that does happen
that way. Does, if the woman, the female, is impregnated by numerous males, can only one of them fertilize?
No, actually, multiple males can fertilize. Birds have kind of a strange thing that the females seem to have some control over who, if they mate with multiple males, there's sperm competition going on, and somehow the female can influence which of those is successful. We don't know how that works exactly, but we can just kind of look at it and we compare the numbers. We can see that happens. Oddly, with these forced copulation things, it's been reported that there's a mated pair, male and female, and the female gets chased and copulated with, then the male sometimes goes over and forces himself on her too, without doing all the head bobbing kind of thing. And people think that's because that he's just trying to get in there to compete more. You know, whoever has the most sperm is most likely to win in terms of fertilizing the eggs. But that doesn't always happen.
As I say,
you can see if you take the time to look in, say, December, look around and you can see some nice, safe, friendly sex going on among the ducks, too.
So you're saying normal, if you will, mating rituals happen before the need for, I guess, what would it be, procreation?
They do. And it's unusual in birds for them to do that, but ducks are quite visible examples of the fact that they use sex for pairing up, making pairing decisions, as well as actually trying to create offspring.
Now, I had heard, and maybe you can, it's along the lines of what you mentioned, that the female's vagina has cul-de-sacs in it, and that
she doesn't actually have a vagina. So, but for sperm storage, is that what you've heard?
Right, and that that she can have it go different ways and not actually inseminate.
Well, that's not quite right. The internal anatomy of ducks is a little different than people, and so they don't have actually a vagina per se, but they do have in some places storage vesicles that actually can keep sperm stored for a while. And yeah, there does seem to be some sort of physical control that the females can exert over who wins out in the fertilization thing. But also they store sperm. So the way this works is that typically a duck that lays, let's say 20 eggs, she usually inseminates each of those, fertilizes an embryo a day. And so it isn't like they all get fertilized and they're all developing. There's only room in the oviduct for one egg at a time. And so they all have to come down the chute, the same chute, and it's only big enough for one egg. So what happens is the one egg comes down, then there's more sperm that goes up, either from these storage vesicles or from a fresh copulation, and then that gets fertilized, and the shell and all that stuff gets put on one at a time. So it takes a little bit of time.
And how many eggs do they usually lay?
Oh, you know, you caught me on that one. It's usually a dozen or two.
So that takes, like, a half a month?
Takes
or
a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it does take a while. And the thing is, she doesn't actually start incubating them, putting heat on them till they're all done. And then, so because what you don't want is you don't want one young hatching 3 weeks before another, because they leave the nest as soon as everybody hatches. And there are a couple of ways they do it. One is that she doesn't start them incubating, which gives them enough heat to start growing. So they're just sitting there in sort of suspended animation for a while till she gives them heat. But the eggs also talk to each other, that the ducklings make small noises inside the egg, and somehow that helps them coordinate their growth. That if some, and again, we don't know how this works, but we know that it does, that the younger ones can, the last laid eggs can speed up and the first ones can slow down a little bit till they all come out.
Now,
all
when,
the same, cute little fluffy ducks.
When she's laying the eggs, is she physically expressing them onto the ground, or is she keeping them
into,
into the nest? So from 1 to 24 is 24 days, roughly.
That's right.
And they sit there unprotected.
Oh, they're protected. They're not unprotected. She covers them, and she can sit on top of them without pushing her warm body down on them. And as soon as they lay them, they're protected. But
if she's busy copulating in between dropping an egg, then at some point she has to leave the nest, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah,
so,
and she has to feed, she has to eat. So yeah, I mean, duck nests can be sort of hard to find. What they do is the female tears a whole lot of feathers out of her breast, the down, and makes this nice fluffy thing that actually sort of has down lips over it, or edges that kind of fold over a little bit. And if some ducks, given enough time, like if you don't just scare them off their nest, before they leave, they can arrange things so they're mostly hidden.
Hmm. That's fascinating. So that has to hurt to tear the feathers out, right?
Well, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I would imagine it's akin to plucking a hair, if not
yeah,
more.
Yeah, well, I assume, although one suspects that after thousands of generations of ducks ripping their breast feathers out, that maybe the ones that didn't mind so much gave a little more down and therefore might have been a little more successful. So maybe it's not so painful anymore.
Or desensitize the area?
Yeah, something like that.
So,
or the feathers could be something at the base that could be changed such that they're easily pulled out. That happens in some species of birds. Some of the little barbs on the feathers break off more easily than most feathers. But I don't know that for
fact. Now, when she's done with whatever number her body or her instincts determine is enough, then she sits on them most of the time unless she needs to eat?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And in a mated pair, the pair, the males give no parental support. They don't, once the kids hatch, he's gone. But while she's incubating, he stands guard and can keep, let her know if there's something coming, but also keep other ducks away so she's got good food and that the other ducks aren't eating all the food around the area where her nest is.
Does the male ever sit on the eggs while she...
No, never.
And
never. And she does go over and visit him. He has a spot that he sits, and she'll come off and go over and visit him. And when she's egg laying and all of that, or still egg laying, then that's where they typically copulate down in there. But so they maintain their pair bond not very long, but long enough, at least a few weeks into the whole egg laying thing. But then, as I say, once the chicks hatch, then most of the males just leave.
They flee
the female. Because they don't feed. The easy thing about being a duck is that you don't have to feed your babies. They find their own food instantly. You just have to guard them and shepherd them around.
And that's
why it doesn't matter if the male's there or not, because he wouldn't be adding food to them anyway.
And how long does it take for the eggs to hatch?
Oh, boy, again, I'm giving you a ballpark because I know exactly how long crow eggs take to hatch because that's what I study. But it's somewhere around 30 days, something like that.
And then how long do the chicks follow their mom around?
For a month or two,
until
they can fly, actually well into the summer. In some birds, some ducks, they group up that they you can see chicks that actually don't belong to that mom, or you can see two moms leading a very large group of ducklings. And they do that because they can get some safety out of it, but it doesn't matter because there's enough food. They aren't really competing for food at that point, and the ducklings find it all themselves, so it doesn't matter. You don't care who's sitting next to you, really, because you're not feeding them anyway.
And so the science is ornithology.
That's correct.
And that's what you and that's the study of birds in general?
That is. And that's the name of our lab here at Cornell, Cornell Lab of Ornithology. We're affiliated with the university, but we're actually a membership organization on our own. We try to help people learn things about birds. We're trying to save the world through birds.
One bird at a time.
One person at a time, basically. But, we try to do lots of birds at a time sometimes.
And how did you get into ornithology?
Well, I've always been interested in animals in general, and birds you can see do stuff. You know, mammals, like, mostly are out at night, and so birds like to be seen because they talk that way, and that's a big part of it for me. And then once you get into it, they're odd enough that they're not like people, but they're fascinating, they're interesting, they're beautiful. Lots of cool things.
And
they're everywhere. You know, that's a nice thing, too, is wherever you go, you see different birds. So that's fun.
And why is it that you chose crows?
No, you don't have enough time for that. Crows are fascinating animals. Fascinating animals. They have an incredibly complex social system that's very much like us, actually. It's probably the single social system among all animals that's the most like Western human culture, that they live in family units. It's a male and female, and their kids that stay with them for a number of years. They live in a community that does a big community watch kind of thing. They come and go from their defended territory, and when they go somewhere, they hang out with other crows. It's very much like people.
But that's the
main thing for that. I find all bird behavior interesting, and crows just happen to be like right at the top of the list.
Now, my folks had birds that would mate and make a nest every year outside their home in the desert, and they said that those, I don't know what species it is, but they would mate for life.
Oh, yeah. And again, mate for life means they hang out together till one of them dies, and then they find a new mate. Okay, it's not like you remain a widow your entire life.
Right.
Because that's selected against. All the widow, the lonely widow genes died out while the merry widow genes passed on. So you know, there is selection pressure going on there. I should say that I teach a course here at the lab. It's an online course in bird behavior that's open to, it's non-credit, and it's just for people that are interested in birds, interested in talking about things. We actually do talk about mallards and mating systems and crows and all of that stuff in it. It's called Investigating Behavior, Courtship, and Rivalry in Birds. And if your listeners are interested, they can go to birds.cornell.edu/courses and find some information about that there.
I will promote that on the website when we post this interview, because you've just tipped the iceberg. And it sounds fascinating, these other things that I didn't even know about.
Oh, my goodness. There's so much out in the world that we don't know about. That's part of the fun of being a scientist, is that I learn new things every day, every day.
Mm-hmm.
Every day I get up and I'm sort of excited about it. I wonder what new things I'll see out there. And I've been watching crows for 25 years. but I see new things all the time. The world is just amazingly complex. It's like the Calvin and Hobbes book. It's like there's treasure everywhere.
So, Dr. McGowan, how is it that birds are able to eat deceased and diseased carcasses and not get sick?
Well, they have a couple of things going for them. One is a strong immune system, and they have a fairly high acid content in their stomachs. We actually, as humans, have a little better resistance to rotted meat than most organisms do, indicating that we probably were mostly scavengers in our past as well. There are, you know, certain makeups of things that you're susceptible to in ways that enzymes in saliva and that kind of stuff. Because a lot of things, they wouldn't touch anything that died 2 seconds ago. But mm-hmm. yet we age our beef and, we like some pretty stinky things too.
Well, in tartar, right?
Yeah.
Well, we will post that birds.cornell.edu/courses on our website. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to kind of explain and make rational behavior that I witness.
Well, happy to do it. It's that's sort of what we do at the Lab of Ornithology, and it's always fun to talk about birds for me.
Well, thank you, Dr. Kevin McGowan. Appreciate your time this morning.
You're most welcome.
Take care. So there you have it. And I have seen the savage rite of passage happen way too often, and it's just like, what? In fact, I said I was seeing a therapist at one point, and his offices had brooks and streams in it, not in the office, but on the office complex. And the ducks, and they were engaged. And I said to him, you know, what is the deal? And he goes, every spring I'm ashamed to be a man because of the atrocities that I witnessed. And I was like, yeah, I know. It's like amazing. So the good news is it sounds like it's domesticated behavior and not what happens in general. And then that's the bad news, because they also, you know, if you take your kids to a park and there's ducks and you feed them the breadcrumbs and all that, they say that's bad for their system. They're not used to having the yeast in their system, but I guess they've adapted. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we've got the woman with the Forgiveness Project visiting with us, and she's going to share her story and how it is important to have forgiveness in your life. Maria Sanchez. Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and you're listening to The Maria Sanchez Show on LATalkRadio.com and TheMariaSanchezShow.com, and we're calling our next guest.
Good afternoon, Passion Pictures.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Maria Sanchez from Los Angeles. Looking for Marina, please.
Oh, 1 second.
Thank you. So this is live, raw radio. Would like to thank Don Barrett. He published a nice little piece about our program this morning in LARadio.com. So if you are interested in things radio in Southern California, I suggest you become a subscriber or follow him at laradio.com. So that was sweet of you, Don. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Can I just take your name again, if that's okay?
Maria Sanchez. She's expecting my call.
Okay.
Thank you.
1 second.
So, again, live radio, the number that she gave me this morning that I called right before the program, they said, oh, no, she's at a different number. We're going to get that number to you. So I got this number at 859, and so it wasn't, I guess, vetted. That's what happened when we do live radio. And again, forgiveness is in the news because of some of these stories that have come out. The Brenda Heiss, who is the Pennsylvania mom who abandoned her two children. She turned up in Florida 11 years later. She's in jail not for that, but in a warrant for allegedly violation of her probation, forgery, and giving a false name to law enforcement. So her family that she abandoned, she has a son, a daughter, and she was going through a divorce, who he had her declared dead in 2010 so they could get closer. They find out that she's alive, and it's like, okay. So, hello?
Hello.
Hi, is this Marina?
Yes, it is.
Good morning.
Yes,
well,
hi.
what time is it where you're at?
Oh, it's like gone 5 or nearly, yes, no. I got a bit muddled with the time.
Yeah. So Marina has created something called the Forgiveness Project. So Marina, give us a little background about why you did that, and then I'd like to talk in depth about forgiveness itself.
Well, my background's journalism, and it was around 2002 or 3, and it was the lead up to the war in Iraq. And as a journalist, I felt the language was very much about retaliation and revenge at that time. So as a private and personal project, I just started collecting stories about forgiveness, people who had experienced atrocity but not responded with further violence. And I thought it would be a one-off newspaper article, perhaps, but it was seen by a social activist, entrepreneur, someone called Anita Roddick, who was the founder of the Body Shop chain. And she was so moved by the story, she said, you have to put this on as an exhibition, which we did, me and the photographer who'd taken the photographs, I'd written up the stories. And that was January 2004, and I thought my life would go back to, you know, mainstream journalism, but I'd never done anything in my entire life, really, that had, or journalistic life, I should say, that had inspired so much enthusiasm. And I think at that time particularly, it was, they were narratives of hope. At a very bleak time. And everyone was, well, everyone, you know, people from all around the world literally were sending me emails and saying, how can we use these stories that you've collected? What else are you doing? And I knew at that point that it wasn't going to leave me alone. And it's nearly 10 years later, so we started a not-for-profit and we run programs in prisons and schools and put on events and training programs and lectures, and it's all about exploration and inquiry around this concept of forgiveness and reconciliation.
Now,
that's in a nutshell is what how it started.
So can you give us some examples of stories that have touched people most?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are over 100 now on the website, and for instance, an American one that some of your listeners might be aware of is Bud Welch, whose daughter was killed in the Oklahoma bombing. And the reason why I like his story is he really sort of unpicks the process of forgiveness in that for the first year he was hell-bent on wanting revenge. But then he kind of describes how it was actually serving him badly. Resentment and bitterness had taken root in his heart. And as he turned up at the bomb site every day and his life was literally collapsing around him, his family, his relationships, his work, he just thought, I have to do something differently because what I'm doing isn't working. And it, so forgiveness for him was literally a decision from one day to the other that he had to broaden his perspective. And then the story is all around how he starts campaigning against the death penalty for Tim McVeigh, who was responsible, and how he then met the father of Tim McVeigh, Bill McVeigh, and how in the end he saw him as a bigger victim than himself even. He said, while he could always speak lovingly of his daughter, Bill McVeigh probably doesn't even say he has a son. So it's this whole sense of empathy and compassion. And as he started to embrace forgiveness, his life expanded. So I think, you know, that's just an example. But there are many, and we've got stories from Rwanda and Israel, Palestine, Kenya, UK, Canada. So, and all of them take a different aspect. In a sense, it's not an easy subject, forgiveness. And I really wanted to expose the complexity, if you like. And very key to the whole thing is that this is an inquiry. I'm very against kind of pushing forgiveness as the best and only way forward and a panacea for all ills, because I don't think that serves anyone.
Now, Marina, there must be a process that one has to go through. Like they say with grieving, there's a process.
Mm-hmm.
So to get from having a grudge or having suffered or having pain to be able to forgive, are there steps that you go through? Or are there? What's the range of emotions?
Well, I mean, I'm talking, obviously I've read a lot around the subject. I am a journalist. I collected lots of stories. So it's, the evidence is anecdotal. And the main thing is that there is no set pattern. However, there is process. Everyone goes through process. And I'd say, it, very like the grieving process, you know, anger is a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Time is massive. You know, with Bud Welch, it took a year. For others, it takes decades. And very often, it'll be something or someone who triggers a different way of thinking, a larger perspective. But on other hand, on other cases, it will be just that you get worn down by holding on to the resentment and the hatred and the bitterness, because that does have a cost in the end. And I think it can be quite an emotional thing, and it can be a decisional thing, and it can be a result of a relationship with an other person. So I know that people do teach forgiveness, and there are useful steps that you can go through. And quite a lot has been written up about that, and there are even courses you can go to. But what we do at the Forgiveness Project is present the real stories of real people who've been there and done it. And that in itself kind of inspires people to look at their own lives and their own forgiveness processes and journeys and their resentments.
I think
that's the way I like to do it, really, to inspire people to do it themselves.
Well, I've had just a few instances in my life where I've held on to some negative thoughts, and mostly it's been around my marriage has failed. And my first husband, who's the father of my four children, I had a huge axe that to grind because of what he didn't do with the family. And I stumbled upon forgiveness because I used to say, well, it's not forgivable because this, that, and this, and that. You know, I had all these reasons. And then one day I realized, whatever the reasons are, I'm holding on to that. It's not allowing me to move forward in some aspects of my life. It's not serving him at all because he doesn't care whether I what I think about him. So when I let that go, it felt like I was unburdened, if you will. And I don't know
if that's similar.
Yeah. I mean, my story is small compared to some of the cases that you highlight. I understand that, and I don't want to demean them at all by comparing it to a social issue. But is that what others have experienced?
Yes, very much so. I think forgiveness is not about excusing an offense. It's not about necessarily reconciling with the offender. It's entirely to do with taking hold of painful emotions and deciding to let them go. So you do it for yourself. It's an act of self-healing. That's not to say that in that process it doesn't rehabilitate the offender. You know, it will have a repercussion very often. But I think you do... people do it for themselves, yeah, and I think it's interesting your experience. It completely echoes many of the stories that I've heard, yeah.
And how did you find your initial subjects when you wrote the first piece?
Well, when I was actually just collecting the stories during the whole year, really, of 2003, I was doing quite a lot of traveling with Oxfam and Red Cross just for my journalistic life. And so wherever I went, I sort of sought out, you know, in my spare time, other stories. So it was very much location-led. And so Northern Ireland and South Africa, because I went to both those places, collected a lot of stories from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa and of course, part of the peace process in Northern Ireland. And also, during that time, I'd realized that in order to understand why violence happens, why people hurt people, we also needed to hear the stories of those who committed acts of violence, people who'd now turned their minds to peace building. So that was very interesting. And sometimes those people were joined, like in a restorative justice way, that the victims had actually met the offenders and stayed friends with them. So I would interview both of them together. So there were a few stories like that as well.
Wow, that seems phenomenal.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, and I think that's an incredible healing process to actually meet and talk to and ask why from the person who's committed an offense against you.
And how could they find friendship?
Friendship?
Yes. I would think that that would be the
rarely.
Last.
Rarely. I have to say, friendship is rare. It has happened in a few cases. More often, they might work together in a friendly manner. I only know of a couple that will actually hang out together and, you know, meet at the pub or in the cafe for a drink. But normally, it is acceptance, compassion, empathy, forgiveness. But they have a kind of working relationship in that they often speak publicly in order to inspire people to think about concepts of restorative justice and forgiveness.
Because forgiveness is an active act. It's not passive.
Yeah, it's active, exactly. And you have to keep doing it. I think it's a fallacy to think that once you've forgiven someone, that it's necessarily just that's how it always is. Because we're all human. We all have triggers. And people, something can happen and take you back to where you were before. So it's something you do every day, I think.
So it's not a one-time thing. You have to revisit it.
Having said that, it's not a one-time thing. I'm sure some people will say, it was this moment when everything changed for me. So there are moments of profound change. But I think people are vulnerable. You know, when you've been wounded, easy to trigger something back again. You have to be careful and look after yourself. But I think the overall thing about forgiveness, you know, it's difficult, it's messy, it's complicated, it's costly, but it is potentially transformative. It changes life, it transforms relationships. And for me, that's what's really interesting about it. And there's so much research out there to say people who have a more forgiving attitude have much better health outcomes. So as a public health tool, if nothing else, it's kind of like sensible for all of us to kind of think about forgiveness and about how we might use it more in our own lives. I know, I don't know about in America, but it kind of cuts public opinion down the middle like a guillotine here. People are either affronted by it or inspired by it. It seems to attract strong reactions.
It's polarizing.
Polarizing.
Marina, in terms of forgiveness, how could anybody argue against it?
Well, people can see it as something that, for instance, might break up families, because you can imagine you might not, say, in a very extreme case of murder or something, if one person goes down the forgiveness route and wants to even meet the perpetrator, other members of the family might see it as that betraying the memory of the person. And I have seen families fractured. For a time, anyway, because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's people are often saying, surely if you forgive it, you're allowing the abuse to continue. You're just saying, let's think of a battered wife syndrome. Mm-hmm. You know, you stay and you keep forgiving. And there is that sense as well, that there is some truth in that. But my feeling about that, actually, you can walk away. You know, you need to look after yourself. You need to be safe. There are times when you need to walk away from a relationship, but even so, you can still forgive that person, because forgiving is about seeing that person who does this to you as fallible, as imperfect, as possibly possessed by demons, as brainwashed. You know, and also, I think absolute key to it, someone once said to me, whose father had been killed by a bomb, she said, of the bomber, she said she started to embrace forgiveness when she thought, if I had lived your life, perhaps I would have made your choices. You know, that's a very profound understanding.
Key takeaway from my conversation with you this morning is that it's not forgiving the act, but it's forgiving the person.
Yes. Yeah. So, I'm seeing the person as human like you, and all human beings are fallible.
Right. And that was what one of our politicians said this morning. He's running for election, and he cheated on his wife, and he said, I believe the people have forgiven me. I failed, but I am human. Mm. Here we go. We're speaking with Marina today about forgiveness. So, Marina, you want to go ahead and pitch the website before we say goodbye?
Yeah, it's www.theforgivenessproject.com.
And thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And that's something for us to consider, forgiveness. This is Maria Sanchez. Thank you for listening to The Maria Sanchez Show. We look forward to visiting with you tomorrow morning.
Thank you for listening to The Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio. and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.